In a city that basks in its history, very few people understand the powerful legacy of Boston merchants who became millionaires trading in opium.
That money changes the face of Boston and makes it possible for Boston to develop a reputation as one of the world's true civic cities.
Salem State University professor Dane Morrison is among the historians who will take us this morning from the wharves of 19th century Boston to the poppy fields of Turkey and the shores of China. Boston merchants traded chests filled with the addictive drug for delicate porcelain dishes, richly colored silks, and, as the saying goes, all the tea in China. WBUR's Martha Biebinger begins our story on January 2nd, just after the New Year in 1826.
On this chilly day, we might find an elegant gentleman with a full head of white hair pacing the halls of his stately Boston townhouse or his Brookline mansion. Thomas Handyside Perkins, a leading merchant, has been speculating with shipments to China for nearly 40 years, but now he may have gone too far. Perkins settles behind his desk and drafts an apology to his nephew and business partner in the port city of Canton. Or maybe the letter is a warning. More than 150,000 pounds of Turkish opium is on its way.
As respects opium, I must take all the blame in going as far as we have. I thought it best to extend ourselves to prevent intruders. I am mortified that the quantity that will go out in the spring so far surpasses your wishes.
But the nephew and other relatives who work for Perkins and Company just might be able to handle this risky order. They've spent more than a decade building an elaborate operation in China to protect their most valuable commodity, opium. They're among the first Americans to have a permanent office in Canton, what's now Guangzhou. Agents there store the illegal drug in ships offshore so they can regulate supply and price. They've developed relationships with smugglers and corrupt government officials. They equip boats manned by dozens of rowers to speed past inspectors, sneak up the coast, and deliver opium beyond the official port. The Perkins & Company business plan pays off again and again. On January 11, 1827, 1 year after the apology, Perkins is back at his desk. This time, the message to his nephew sounds almost giddy.
I have written and thought so much of opium that it gives me an opiate to enter upon the subject.
Perkins could have been high on the excitement of success or the money coming in. That year, an associate says Perkins is worth more than $1 million, which translates to about $25 million today. The Brits controlled the vast majority of opium sales in China. But among American traders, Perkins & Company dominated merchants who stopped in Turkey to buy opium, delivered it to the shores and dens of China, and returned to Massachusetts with delicate dishes, expensive fabrics, and new varieties of tea. Perkins & Company created fortunes for a network of in-laws, nephews, and cousins, says John Rogers Haddad, a professor of American Studies at Penn State.
That company generated a tremendous amount of revenue and profit. Multiple people, not just Thomas Perkins himself, were made millionaires by the trade.
Of course, not everyone struck it rich dealing opium in China, but those who did are remembered today as Boston Brahmins. The list includes Cabots, Cushings, Wells, Delanos, as in Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and Forbes. They used opium profits to build mills in Lowell and Newton, establish banks, start mines, and lay railroads across the country. Haddad is among a handful of historians exploring the connection between America's Industrial Revolution and the opium trade, where, again, the key players were from Boston.
China had a really strong economy in the early part of the 19th century, and the Americans were able to tap into that by exchanging tea for opium. Opium was really a way that America was able to transfer China's economic power to America's Industrial Revolution.
Perkins' ships deposited tremendous wealth in Boston, too. Picture chests of tea, bolts of silk, crates of porcelain, and yes, cakes of opium, which was legal in the U.S. Dock workers hauled the cargo onto giant scales outside Boston's Custom House.
It would have been tallied and taxed here at the Custom House, and it would have filled the warehouses of Faneuil Hall and Quincy Market.
Salem State Professor Dane Morrison points out that import taxes were the main source of government revenue in the 19th century.
A city that brings a great many trade goods is a city that's going to be very wealthy.
That opium-based tax revenue funded Massachusetts police and fire departments, roads, bridges, courthouses, and schools.
And a lot of that money goes to charity and funds many of Boston's prominent institutions.
Consider the legacy of Just Perkins and his brother. They helped found Massachusetts General Hospital, McLean's, and the Boston Athenaeum. Thomas Perkins championed construction of the Bunker Hill Monument, and he donated one of his homes for a new school that would be called Perkins School for the Blind.
He was, quote, one of the noblest specimens of humanity to which our city has ever given birth.
Jennifer Arnott, the research librarian at Perkins School for the Blind, reads from a eulogy for Perkins. The School for the Blind and other institutions contacted for this story did not know that their benefactors got rich selling an illegal drug in China. After digging into Perkins' business history, Arnott reasons that he, like other merchants, followed demand.
I think it really was a sort of awareness that you did the trade that was there and that you looked for the opportunities that made sense for your business at that point.
Arnott says Perkins' peers likely knew and weren't bothered by the fact that opium was a key source of his wealth.
It wasn't that they were doing anything that was illegal or even particularly socially disapproved of.
There was a robust debate among merchants about the morality of selling opium to the Chinese, where more than 2 million residents were addicted by the mid-1800s. One New York merchant refused to trade the drug, calling it an evil of the deepest dye. Members of the Perkins firm argued that opium was no worse than alcohol, which was traded freely. Among the great-great-grandchildren, nieces, and nephews of Boston's opium barons, some never discussed the source of family wealth. Others knew the history and teased each other about it.
The boys in my family, my uncles, were quite wicked to my grandmother.
This is Phyllis Forbes Kerr, remembering dinners with her grandmother at the Forbes Mansion in Milton. It's now a museum.
We would sit at the table, and then she'd say something about Forbes, and they'd say, oh, you mean the drug dealer? And she'd get really mad.
Sitting in her Cambridge living room, Kerr pulls out a map of Boston Harbor at the height of the China trade.
These are all the ports. You know, you just looked out. There were tons of ships there all the time. I mean, it's crazy.
And yet, Bostonians rarely talk about what local merchants sold to the Chinese, opium. Kerr says it's time for that to change. It's hard to say where a reckoning with the legacy of opium profits would lead. Binghamton University Assistant History Professor Dale Norwood studies the politics of 19th century Chinese-American trade.
You know, there's a lot of money still sloshing around that has its origins here. And I think that we need to recognize and account for what it means to be the beneficiaries of that money and what that changes about our obligations to the rest of the people in society, including people who are harmed by it.
That's primarily the Chinese, but Boston would not escape the scourge of opium. More on that tomorrow. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Martha Biebinger.